1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Let me just ask a question to start up, and break in, please, or change questions, or any, just, you know, try to get this, what we're here for. Why do you think that this, quote, Negro revolt, Negro revolution, has taken place now and not earlier?
Well,
what are the factors involved there?
The change from an agrarian nation to a city dweller's nation, the moving from the farms into the cities, and especially as far as the colored people in this section is concerned, they're moving to California, Detroit, Chicago, not so many New Yorkers after World War I, but even locally, moving to New Orleans, Shreveport, the large cities. In the past, even in the cities, there were certain jobs that were known as Negro jobs. There was an economy that included the Negro in a menial position. Barbers, waiters, street cleaners, chauffeurs. There was no difficulty in getting a job. Various other groups began to take over these jobs so that getting a job became more competitive. And also, labor was organized in such a way that there were actually four labor battalions. White male at the highest salary scale, then white female next, then lower Negro male, and then lowest Negro female, and the darker groups were frequently used as strike breakers, and sometimes just to keep the cost of production down. But these separate battalions of labor have been disappearing, so that the Negro no longer can apply for a job with the Negro battalion as they formerly did. So it's an economic problem. In too many instances, people, Negroes coming to the cities, have found themselves destitute and seeking refuge in relief and charity. And so the reason I believe why this revolt is so pronounced at the present time is that the economic problem in America for an existence in an urban nation, or a nation that is rapidly becoming urban, becomes so competitive that the Negro has to be able to compete on an equal economic level.
How much does the specter of automation have to do with this, do you think?
I don't think on the surface of it, it has a lot to do with it. But beneath the surface, it has a lot to do with it. What I mean is this, that most of the companies that use persons who have to have specialized training to operate machines will employ Negroes who are qualified to operate those machines. But on the other hand, like at Esso, right here in our own neighborhood, many of the white people receive their training right there at the plant and learn to operate those machines, whereas Negroes have not been allowed to learn at the plant how to operate those machines. In other words, the unskilled white laborer has been able to advance himself by entering training courses and classes at the business establishment.
On job.
On the job. And the Negro has been denied that right.
That's a policy, is it?
That is a general policy. Not only is that policy true here, but I found it true in the steel mills of Pittsburgh. I lived in Pittsburgh, called it home for 25 years. and I've been teaching in Louisiana 17 years. So I've traveled backward and forth.
Yes, yes. Let me take another approach to the same question, another aspect of it. In the 30s, the early 30s particularly, with the Depression, there was an enormous competition for jobs.
Yes.
And there was a great crowding out of Negroes from jobs that had been traditionally open to them.
That's correct.
And that is 30 years ago. At that time, there was no organized Negro movement to combat this. There was resentment, and there was the impoverishment, and the attitude was clear, but there was no organized movement on the part of the Negroes to change that. Now I'm getting at what is the difference between that time, when the motivation was the same as now, and this time, when it's effective and highly organized.
The biggest difference, as I see it, is that in the 30s, and even during World War II, we saw far more situations, and we still see some of them, in which a Negro receives a lower salary than a white man for doing the same job.
Yes.
But that differential is rapidly disappearing. So that in the 30s, the competition for the lower salary jobs was not as keen as it is now, for the simple reason that the lower salary jobs do not have the differential between the white salary and the Negro salary.
I see the logic of that. Let me ask a question still bearing on this matter. But first, I will say that I sat in a room with two people whom I've known for some time, both of them ministers in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And I asked this question. And one said there was no reason except an accident why it could not have happened 30 years ago. The other one said there was every reason why it couldn't happen 30 years ago. There was a disagreement between them on this point. The point issue being this, that if you, one says that it could not happen in 30, 2 or 3, because there was not the vast number, really vast number now, of educated Negroes who could organize, mount this movement. Education in that 30 years has done that. It's prepared a whole new generation who know the techniques, who are a range of culture, who know the techniques of organization, and whose will is different from the will 30 years ago. Not the desire, but the will. Now these two disagree on this point. As I figured it out, the one who said it could have happened earlier, though he couldn't have substantiated that, could have happened earlier, really flinched from the idea of this being a matter of historical process and not a matter of an absolute of some kind. But his friend, they're close friends, saw it as an evolutionary process, an opening process. In other words, it seemed to be a charged issue.
Yes.
Between them.
Well, I think you'll find that...
What you would think about that?
One big difference between the last generation and this generation, the generation of World War One, running right on up to 1940, is a difference in stability and home ownership, even though home may be just a farm.
Yes.
But where there's stability, where there's home ownership, where there is a certain degree of economic security, people are not as apt to revolt, even in their thinking. as they are when they are uprooted. In other words, many of the people have left their farms, they have left their homes. Many of them do not own their homes now, but as I recall in the in my childhood and coming on up through World War I, World War II, it was a matter of a social position for a person to own his home. And the people who own their homes, the colored people who own their homes, to my recollection, for the most part, were people who found some kind of gainful employment in the neighborhood of their home, of whose nothing but farming. But that day has passed. And the second thing is that there has been a change in the Negro's religious outlook. At that time, Christianity among Negroes was a matter of humility. It was a matter of meekness. The church was his stronghold of organization. My father was a minister, and I knew it from the viewpoint of a minister's family. In those days, a person felt that he was out of step with society. A Negro felt that he's out of step with society if he didn't go to church every Sunday and if he didn't support his church, which gave the ministers a dual role, that of formulating their beliefs and being a symbol for their beliefs on the one hand, and on the other hand, of giving them some sort of social unity in the community. But now there are too many transients. There are too many people who are moving backward and forth from one place to another to have any deep roots in any one church, any one community church.
How does this... Stop, sorry, please.
The second thing is that my observation is that now we have many Negroes who don't attend church, have no membership in church, and they have no beliefs to cling to. But the only thing they're interested in is sound economic survival.
Now, how does this relate to the fact that much of the leadership, particularly in the South, has been from the churches in the last 5 years, 7 years?
The South, not just the South, but to a large extent the North, likewise. I'm thinking of such persons as Adam Clayton Powell.
Yes.
The North has found a source of organization and unified action in the Negro Church. And wherever their problems have risen, the only organization which the Negro as a whole has been able to turn to has been the church. He has no other large, influential organization or group of organized persons to take action. Furthermore, you will notice that most of these leaders come from the Protestant churches and I believe the Baptist church, where the church itself, the neighborhood church, is a sovereign body. And along democratic procedures, the minister usually carries out the will of the body. And if the body politic pushes the minister to take the position of leadership, and if he has the sort of influence with them that he leads them to believe that he can be such a leader, why, he not only has confidence in the fact that his church will support him, but they, in turn, have confidence in their minister and will follow his leadership. Now, I think your point is that despite the fact that there has been a loss of religious fervor and unity among the Negroes throughout the country, that still the leadership comes from the church. The fact still remains that that is their basic social organization.
You think that this is a secularization of the church rather than a continuing religious function, is that it?
Yes, I would agree with that.
I think that
yes.
Frazier uses that word, the secularization, I believe, the
yes.
church in its general sense.
Yes, that movement has been on foot now for 40 or 50 years, turning the church into a community service. Aged mother's rest, orphanage, playground, swimming pool, classes, with the idea of religious education and making the church residual in its educational function. And in many instances, even using the church as a springboard for political support.
As it's happened in Powell's.
And again, I will say, principally because the Negroes have had no other large social organization, such as, for instance, Kiwanis.
Yes, yes. So,
or
yes.
They do have their secret orders, but they're not large and influential.
Now, what about this aspect of it? We find with people like Dr. Abernathy and Dr. King, and we won't name them all, we know a number of them, where you have a definite theological and moral bias, where it's not a secularized church that is functioning, but a church is depending on its theology as a device, as the nonviolence of Lawson, the nonviolence of King, the nonviolence of Abernathy, which has a theological orientation, has a Christian orientation. Sometimes it's modified by, say, Gandhi, an example in one thing and another.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not a secularization, is it? We still have something carried over then from the church as a religious organization. Is that true?
It may be. It may go further than just the Christian religion. It may go into transcendentalism. It may go into Thoreau's civil disobedience.
Yes.
It may go back to the idea of popular sovereignty, which is, incidentally, a part of the dogma of many Protestant churches, and especially the Baptist Church, the sovereignty of the people. But
yes.
that, in turn, grows out of the humanitarian impulse, which is more classical than Christian.
Yes.
However, I don't find any logical basis for separating the two.
Well, I don't propose a separation that is logical,
mm-hmm.
but there's a question of emphasis in the use of the institution, where you have the appeal to, well, transcendental or Christian grounds as opposed to merely organizational grounds.
Well, I think it would be oversimplifying it to say that it is any one to the exclusion of the other.
Well, I'm certain that would be true. I'm certain that would be true.
In other words, I think they are opportunists who use the organization of the church to foster their programs. That is not to say that their programs are not worthy.
Oh, no, that's nothing. That's
but I will also say that there are some, and I believe that persons like Powell and Martin Luther King are persons that would fall in this classification who are merely caught in the sweep of events, and they could not be true to their congregations if they did not carry out the wishes of their congregation. Such is the organization of the Baptist Church.
Tell me this, Lisa, one reads from the time of Du Bois on to the present,
mm-hmm.
on to James Baldwin, anywhere, and all in between, the problem of the basic psychic split for the American Negro of this sort. I even have a quotation here from Du Bois on it. I scribble down for this purpose. On one hand, a sense of identity with, loyalty to, a Negro community, a Negro tradition, even an African tradition. This is one identification, one loyalty, one sentiment. As opposed to another sentiment, loyalty, identification, which would lead to the integration in a full sense, either everything from not matters of civil rights, but projected into the loss of racial identity, even by blood mingling, absorption in the outnumbering white population. This division, for some people, is a very real problem. It's a very real split. For some Negroes, it is, and even those whom it's not a problem of anguish. Is a subject of speculation as to where loyalty, where identity lies. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you?
Well, it is a very profound problem. It's very difficult to even orientate the problem for the simple reason that, as I see it, the problem is an emotional one, and more so than it is a logical one. The average Negro knows nothing about his African background, no more than what he sees in a mirror.
Yeah.
He knows nothing about his foreparents. He doesn't even know what section of Africa they came from. He knows little about the culture of Africa. It just isn't in his life. So he finds himself in a situation in which he has an open mind for indoctrination. He finds himself in a situation in which he has to evaluate his own personal experiences. On the one hand, he is taught that the white man is full of hatred and prejudice. He also finds that he himself suffers as a result of prejudice. Well, the upshot of this is that the first thing is that he seeks solace in persons who suffer that which he suffers. Furthermore, the social community is arranged in such a way that his living conditions, his living locality, may place him in a particular ghetto of Negro residences, of Negro churches, of Negro business establishments, of Negro schools. So he associates with them freely. But my observation has been that when it comes to prejudice and hatred, that if there is any such thing as evaluating it, there is far more prejudice among colored people towards white people. And there's more hatred among colored people towards white people than there is among white people toward color. I've been in communities where it appeared that the average white person is totally unaware of the existence of a Negro until he sees one. On the other hand, I have observed that the average Negro thinks in terms of race prejudice in all of his social relationships, in all of his economic relationships, and he is constantly eating and sleeping with the idea of prejudice, which creates within him sort of a psychological hatred, if not an emotional hatred. He eats and sleeps with it. And he attempts to circumscribe or exile, excoriate any Negro who appears to be friendly with white people, and especially if there's an intermarriage. I have observed intermarried couples in places like Pittsburgh. For the most part, they couldn't live in Negro communities. The Negroes made it uncomfortable for them. They lived in white communities. I'm trying to remember the name of a club. It was a club of about 50 intermarried couples in St. Paul.
Minnesota?
Yes. Who organized themselves into a social group. But in many instances, what I have observed, that the average Negro resents any member of his race marrying a white person. And he then turns his bitterness toward that Negro who has married a white person. If a person, a Negro, happens to get a job, and in employment in which he may be the only Negro there, and all the other workers beside him are white, he is object of ridicule.
By other Negroes?
By other Negroes. And frequently, they make it very unpleasant for him in their group. There are places right now where I am very uneasy if I should go there. I would say that places that I feel very unwelcome. In fact, I think that they go out of their way to make me feel unwelcome, and sometimes they even say so. For the simple reason that they may see me at some time in conversation with some white person, or he may be visiting my house, or I may be visiting his house, which they would seldom see, or he may be riding in my car. When I was in high school, I was told that Negroes were not allowed to play on the football team, but I went out for the football team, and I made it. And in the evenings, around 4:30 to 5 o'clock, I walked home with the other players, but I was the only colored player. So, one Saturday afternoon, I was approached for socializing with white boys to the exclusion of colored boys. I wouldn't walk home with my own kind. I was attacked, my nose was broken, and two ribs were fractured. That is a personal example of the sort of thing that I mean. The Negro resents any other Negro being accepted or seeking.
In other words, to cut back on the starting point there, the feeling of identification with the Negro group is so strong there that it acts as uses a weapon against any Negro who tries to move or does move, however naturally and simply, into white association, white society.
Now that is correct. In some instances, it is very violent. But in most instances, it's just a resentment. Just a resentment which may be expressed and may not be expressed.
Now, if that's true on one side of the question, that's one pole of the discussion. The other one being the impulse to move into the white society in the broad sense of the word, to break down all barriers of all kinds, identify with or a projected society where race has ceased to exist, or may have ceased to exist, where we can't predict that, we assume this is a biological possibility, at least. Or certainly, where there are no distinctions of friendships or relations based on race.
I'm reminded of...
They're quite opposite things, aren't they?
Yes.
Now, but there is a split.
Definitely. There is a split, but I would say it's one of which the average Negro is not aware.
Except
just doesn't think of it in that way.
But the literate ones think of it.
Oh, yes.
The literature is full of it. The literature of the subject is full of it. I mean, beginning from even before Du Bois, it's full of it. It's there.
Yes, it's there.
It's as early as Frederick Douglass.
But I might further point out that the average Negro, in my opinion, is not at all interested in amalgamation or social equality. He's interested in economic security and economic.
Yes, let's grant. That is the immediate mm-hmm. lead, the immediate objective.
Mm-hmm.
But the other things, as barriers dissolve, friendships take place which otherwise not have occurred.
Mm-hmm. You mean it's inevitable?
It's inevitable. Human mm-hmm. associations take place of all kinds, and this, what the, nobody knows what the result of this is. But at least the withdrawal of black Muslim withdrawal. Or the resentment of the Negro, any other Negro who moves into a white association of some kind, mm-hmm. would no longer exist, presumably. It'll be a society of free mobility. And these two, the impulse toward free mobility and the impulse toward identification with Negro groups, its extreme form, black Muslims, attitudes, are two quite contradictory impulses.
Yes. And I think that ultimately they will split the American Negro into two groups.
That's what I'm getting at. You think it really will?
I think it will. I think there will be some who, from any of several viewpoints, even the aesthetic viewpoint, there are some who feel that the typical Negroid traits, features, facial features, bodily features, are beautiful, and they want to preserve them. There are some who are just as adamant about that as, I would say, the Irish are in New York, still clinging to their St. Patrick's Day tradition, as the Jews are all over the world. And to some extent, I believe, Chinese in their various Chinatowns.
Yes.
Especially when it comes to intermarriage, they attempt to preserve the stock.
Yes.
But I also believe that there will be some who will swing in the other direction and will be swallowed up by the white race.
I have a friend who is a psychiatrist in Connecticut, who's a Jew, and he has talked about this division of impulse among the Jews.
Yes, they have the Orthodox and the Conservative.
And the fact of the Jew who's a non-Jew, even, who's a Jew by blood, if whatever blood means there, and by heritage, but has no theological, you know, ties.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes
like friend,
has changed his name to an English name.
He may have. My friend hasn't, but he's not in any sense acting as non-Jew. He says, I am a Jew. But mm-hmm. he has no theological ties.
I see.
He only has
a cultural sentiment. The conservative
see.
Jew is compared with the Orthodox.
This man is, he's outside of Jewishness in any theological sense.
Oh, he
sense.
Is.
He's a scientist, and he's totally outside of that. But he mm-hmm. says he himself feels this pull, mm-hmm. a split.
Mm-hmm.
This man is a psychiatrist. He says, I feel it myself. And then he was talking about the same thing among some Negro colleagues of his, one psychiatrist, and then some other medical men, Negro medical men, who had said to him they felt this split in the way he feels as a Jew. The identity, group identity, or racial identity, as opposed to some identification with the open society, say Americanism in theory or something like that.
Let me see, it was somewhere around about 1930 or 1932, the late Kelly Miller made a study of United States census reports. Up to 1920, there were three census reports. Negro. I don't know if you're familiar with the Cyrus Orms families of Ohio and the Manzilla family, which has disappeared because the last Manzilla had eight daughters and no sons,
mm-hmm.
and the Young family and the Warren G. Harding family. Well, they have a Cyrus Orms reunion in Ohio. I was trying to, Lisbon? No, Salem, Ohio, every year. And every year they have a group of members of the family who are white, and a group of members of the family who are colored. And in Caroline County, Virginia, you have the same thing with two families of colored people who are, on the one hand, birds and their cousins, the Carters. And they are proud of the fact that they are descendants of the aristocrat William Byrd and Robert Carter, Naomi Hall. But the amusing thing is that while the Byrds are having their family reunion in Central Point, Virginia, the white Byrds are having theirs in Richmond. The same week.
Same week.
So there's something that has been going on for quite a long while. It goes all the way back to the Rutledge and Mainwaring settlements of West Virginia and Ohio. Mm-hmm. So there's no starting point as far as history is concerned.
No, there's not a starting point.
unless you say the starting point was 1690.
Take that polytrary one. I have a quotation here that I took from Dr. Kenneth Clark on the philosophy of Martin Luther King. This I found fascinating. May I read you this quotation or part of it?
I'd be happy to listen to it.
This is from an essay by Dr. Clark in a book called The New Negro. It was published at Notre Dame a year or so ago. It's a book of essays by about 7 or 8 people. On the surface, King's philosophy appears to reflect health and stability. While black nationalism, he's been talking about the Muslims before this, betray pathology and instability. A deeper analysis, however, might reveal that there is also an unrealistic, if not pathological, basis to King's doctrine. The natural reaction to injustice, oppression, and humiliation are bitterness, resentment. The form that such bitterness may take need not be overtly violent, but the corrosion of the human spirit which is involved seems inevitable. This is back to your remark about the hatred night and day. It would seem then that any demand that the victims of oppression be required to love the oppressors places an additional and probably intolerable burden upon these victims. That's the first quotation from Kenneth Clark. He continues, we'll follow on. It has been argued that the proper interpretation of King's philosophy of love must take into account its Christian background. This argument may be correct for a small minority of educated, philosophically mature individuals, but it is unlikely that it can be accepted with understanding by the masses of Negroes. Their attempt to cope with this type of philosophical abstraction can only lead to deep and disturbing inner conflicts and guilt. And there's a professional psychologist, you see, dealing with a theologian. What do you make of that? I mean, what elements of agreement or disagreement do you find in that?
I am not sure that I understand Clark's two viewpoints, but I think I do.
You want me to paraphrase them again? Sure, quickly, I had to read them. You see, hearing a reading is not
well,
a very good way.
Well, let me hear your interpretation.
Well, it's simply this, that if the King's philosophy, which says, let's recognize a human wherever he is and respect him and love him as human and he will come to terms with us, you respond to this eventually, or seems healthy and seems to be emotionally stable. But it's really, if not pathological, at least very, very unstable. Because the natural human reaction is to resist, to resent. If you ask a man to stop his natural reaction of anger and turn it into love or understanding or forgiveness, then he's going to get sick. He's going to have intolerable burdens of guilt.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was what I thought it meant.
Well, I'm sure I wasn't. I had to read it to you only once. And mm-hmm. How could anyone follow a reading of that length only on one time?
Well, I would say that there is a branch. There are several branches of modern psychology which are incompatible with theology. I would say that any psychological viewpoint based on average and norms is unsound.
Based on what?
Average and norms.
Yes, yes.
Is unsound. I would say that religious practices and religious teachings are not always together. Religious teachings, theology and dogma, creed, are idealistic, something to strive for which the average person never attains. But I would say that there are many branches of psychology that have a tendency to regard the person who does not act as the group acts, who is an individual, who is a thinker, who is a person who clings to his beliefs, regardless of line of logic which is presented, as an abnormal person. I think that any system of psychology which attempts to remove fears, any of the normal emotional responses of a human being, which attempts to make all people fit into a particular mold, which attempts to do away with complexes and rationalizations, is doomed to failure. And whenever you take such a viewpoint, such a bias, as so many of the areas of psychology are wont to do, why, you can make any religious creed or dogma or tenet look psychologically unsound.
Yes.
In other words, there is a place for fear in religion, a very wholesome place for fear in religion, a desirable place for fear in religion. But there is hardly any wholesome, desirable place for fear in what is called the wholesome personality or the well-balanced person.
Well, apparently, Martin Luther King has made this doctrine stick in the face of great provocation. As I talked to a friend of mine who was in Birmingham at the night of the riots, and staying in the motel, and he said in the whole picture in Birmingham at that time, that King could simply somehow draw out the poison. He could convert this anger and resentment was on the verge of wildest action. Somehow he could convert it into his weapon of nonviolence. He said it was magical. So the psychologist might have to reckon with that piece of data. But it worked. Whether these guys are sick later is another thing. It's a collision of two approaches, sure, as you said. The psychological and the theological just don't have much. But somehow, part of the psychological data might very well be King's actual performance, or Abinader's actual performance on the spot. But it has worked. Whether it worked next time, who knows? Do you think that the nonviolence program can continue successfully?
I've been thinking about that. I need a chance for some more observations. What I have observed so far is that there has been more or less a nonviolence program being carried on by NAACP, especially when it was spearheaded by Thurgood Marshall and Nabern. I'm not so sure about the situation as of 63 and 64. On the other hand, there appeared to me, especially in this section, to be a violence program being carried on by Congress of Racial Equality.
A program of violence.
Yes.
How is that? By Corps?
Yes, by Corps. And also in other sections of the country, but not in this particular section, by the black Muslims.
Of course, they're at the other end of the spectrum.
Yes. But especially in Louisiana, Corps has been inclined to incite people to demonstrate, and if necessary, to go into violent demonstrations, whereas the NAACP program has been not a group program. By that I mean they do not depend upon getting large groups of people to demonstrate and act as a group, but rather as an individual approach. One person goes peacefully through the courts up to the United States Supreme Court. Also, I have noticed that NAACP has depended upon persons in key political, social, and religious positions to help mold opinion as far as the United States Supreme Court decisions have been involved. I've also noticed recently, and that's why I spoke as I did, that certain people have at one time been identified with NAACP and at another time been identified with CORE, and I'm referring to certain leaders in given communities.
Well, a person can belong to both, of course.
What is that?
A person can belong to both.
Oh, yes, he can. But I'm referring to a person who is cited in one particular instance as a high official in CORE, and in another instance as a high official, not just a member.
Yes.
In the NAACP. And that confuses me. I'm not sure, under certain circumstances, which group is spearheading a particular action. And that became quite pronounced, I would say, in the last 6 to 9 months, the last half of 1963. But prior to that time, I could see a different procedure. On the one hand, by NAACP, and on the other hand, by Congress of Racial Equality. And I think, if I understand your question correctly, I believe that you can legislate anything into action or prohibition of any particular action, but finally it depends upon public sentiment as to whether or not you have done any good. And I believe that the method used, or that has been used by NAACP, winning friends and influencing people, getting a program before the American people to give them more logical insights into the situation,
yes,
is much more effective in the long run than violence of any kind.
Well, now, CORE has promoted demonstrations, but the demonstrations have been nonviolent, as the demonstrators have accepted arrest or accepted holders or whatever, they haven't struck back. And two of the demonstrations in, you know, Birmingham and Montgomery and other places, CORE and the Southern Christian Leadership Group, King's Group, and SNCC, too. Mm-hmm. They have not struck back. Their theory is nonviolence.
But yes, but
is that running out?
But their theory is also to incite the opposition to violence.
Is it inciting, or is it just by existing?
Or putting yourself in a position in which you have every reason, every logical reason to know that they will be excited to violence. To let the world know, as they put it, to let the world know, let the world see.
Yes.
What the situation is. You see, the Negro has now become aware of the fact that as an American Negro, he is not a forgotten man, that he has an international image. And he's falling back on that international image as far as the American image abroad is concerned in the United Nations and in the Russian satellite countries. And he realizes that Russia and the Russian satellite countries will use every bit of propaganda they can to help them in their particular fight. On the other hand, to give the world an unfavorable picture of America. Therefore, he falls back on demonstrations with the hope that the white group will resort to violence.
Yes, but his position that he takes, as I understand it, is that this is a legal position. He has a right to be there, a legal right to be in this spot on this occasion. If he is attacked, he is being illegally attacked. You know what I mean? But his right is presumably legally valid.
Yes.
And he's attacked, and the attacker is illegal.
Yes.
That kind of provocation, can that be called incitement to violence? If he has a legal right to be there and is attacked by the white man who doesn't want him there.
Well,
that's tricky, isn't it?
It is. It is. But I would say it's something like my seeing a man driving toward a red light at 70 miles an hour. And I know he doesn't have a possible chance to stop. But I have a green light, so I drive my car right out there in front of him. Legally, I am right. Legally, he's wrong.
Yes.
But I think there's an issue that is more profound, more far-reaching.
Yes.
Than that, especially when I see a situation in which people not only presume that violence will take place, but they hope that it will, so that they will give more fuel to their cause.
Tactical violence, then, is,
yes,
as a matter of tactic.
Yes.
Related to that, there's another question I run into often in my reading in these matters, and I had a very cogent statement of it. One is this. This is in that old book, What the Negro Wants, that was published during the war. In 43 it was published by the North Carolina Press. And this is by Gordon B. Hancock.
Virginia Union University.
Now, the color question is a social question, and as such, is not essentially different from any other social problem. And by reason of this fact, it responds to the same pressures of adjustment or maladjustment. Social problems, by their very nature, do not lend themselves instantaneous or absolute solutions. Put that over against Freedom Now slogan, you see. What do we make of it?
Oh, the question is whether Dr. Hancock is limited himself to social problems in a sociological sense, or whether he is including economic problems in the socio-economic sense.
The immediate solution.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah. If he is excluding the economic, well, yeah, then I would say that certainly he has taken into consideration the fact that biases and prejudices and
viewpoints cannot be changed overnight. Emotional reactions cannot be changed overnight. Yes, social changes are very slow. But if he means social including the economic and the political, if he means the culture,
then I would say that you have to take his reaction or his observation with a grain of salt. I do think that we could legislate political and economic regulations which would clear up many of the difficulties under which the Negro has had to labor and still have, in the limited sense, the sociological problems which this generation may never, I believe, will not be able to solve. It could take several generations, if any solution is to ever be reached.
The other question, I won't cut longer for the card, the quotation, though I can't remember, the idea appears often. I have a quotation from a very eminent Negro
historian and sociologist, and I forget which one it is on this point. The point he makes is this, that Negro liberation, integration, is contingent upon its association with causes which affect the whole white population. It cannot be achieved in isolation from a climate of opinion and a climate of a crisis which involves the Negro situation but is distinguishable from it. For instance, the question of the America's image to the world outside now involves us all. It's an American problem. The Negro problem, the Negro effort toward justice in America, insofar as it associates with that, games, if taken in isolation, it will not gain. There's a complex of attitudes that have been built up over some years that make it possible now, by associating the situation of the Negro with certain other issues, so it becomes a general issue, part of a general issue, not an isolated issue. That's the only way toward success in resolving the problem. This relates, of course, to a simpler thing as racism is much less evident now than it was 100 years ago. Lincoln was a racist. A thoroughgoing racist, in a way that only a few Bilbos would be now in public life. The climate has changed. Beg pardon?
I wonder about that. In a certain sense, yes, the climate has changed. But I also believe that it has just become more subtle.
Really?
I think it's become more subtle. I think that the difference, perhaps, is that I get the impression, as I observe diaries and essays, letters written 100, 200 years ago, that the American white man then hated the African as a group, He just hated the conception, but it was just a concept and not a social group, but that he loved the individual.
And as far as any particular segment of American society
constituting a
prescribed African group, which later on came to be called Negro. He just didn't have to face that problem, despite the fact that we think of the antebellum South as a situation in which
Negroes lived in a community together. I find that that was
not at all true. Some of them lived in the big house. Some of them were recognized as left-hand descendants. Yeah. And there were quite a few indentured servants who lived in the cabins with the children. But this is an outgrowth of the end of the Reconstruction period and to a large extent of the urban movement. Because you can go through various sections of Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, as well as Kentucky and Tennessee, and you'll find that a Negro may live on one farm and he may be surrounded completely with white owners.
Sure.
But as the urban movement
took place, especially during
World War I and World War II, you then got a real group organized, not organized in the sense of unity, but I mean as far as living locality is concerned. You begin to get these groups that were more or less isolated in ghettos. Then we got a situation in which the average white man
either became indifferent toward the Negro problem,
he was outright a Negro hater, or he took the other side of the fence. He was
the sort of person who had a humanitarian attitude towards the Negro problem.
He loved the Negro race,
but he hated the individual. In other words, he didn't want any one of them to come into his community and live there. He didn't want any one of them to come in his church. He didn't want any one of them to attend the same school that his children attended. So we got just a reversal of a situation in which the earlier white man loved the individual and hated the race, and now we get a situation in which the person who calls himself a liberal loves the race, but he
yes.
hates the individual.
That's an interesting formulation of it. Let me ask a question that bears on that. It's very, there was, we clearly know what the resistances there were during slave time among the slaves, and that this is not a, you know, a happy, a thoroughly happy occasion.